All right, welcome to Sacred Economics Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Sacred Studies. We are here today with David Braun. We are very pleased to have him on the show. I've been looking forward for the last, couple months now for this conversation to happen, and all day I felt like a little kid, just excited to get you on the show and be able to tune into some of the topics that you are digging into as an individual right now. David, would you like to say hello?
Hi, and it's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me. Sacred Economics, the title says it all. So it's an honor to be here, and thank you.
Oh, so glad to have you. Just as an individual, what you're doing in the world right now really does exemplify the movement that we are talking about in Sacred Economics, the process of awakening the self in our own right, in an individual journey, which we all have gone through and many are going through, and people attracted to this podcast definitely know what we are referencing in that individual process. However, there's a follow-up to that, and that's the awakening of the collective. What I like to talk about of taking the individual awakening and then putting it into a physical manifestation of what a society of higher consciousness, a society of heart-open beings, a society of connectedness and alignment with nature looks like. Now, when looking at your work, you are working towards exactly that. And we were just sharing a few words about how you've been inspired post-awakening to really dig your heels in and dive into issues that are close to your heart. Do you want to give us a little bit of background about these last 15 years since you said you had an awakening experience and what your heart and your wisdom within that has led you through?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've always been a spiritual being for as long as I can remember, but my perhaps my level of commitment or my ability to integrate it would vacillate between you know, kind of all in you know, just barely scratching the surface, and I think many of us do that for a while. And then I, you know, and it was around, I think, early 2000s, I fell in love. And at the time, I was running an events business, a floral and events business in New York City. And we had, you know, big name accounts and really high end, flowers and parties. And my business partner was a little ethically challenged. And you know, I'd watch him do pretty shady stuff to folks, and it always didn't sit well with me. But I didn't really speak up. I didn't really say anything. And so here I was enabling a guy that wasn't really that great in the world. And I had this awakening, and it said, "What on earth are you doing using your voice to advocate for this kind of shady character?" Who's very ethically challenged, when the earth is on fire and when there are so many more important things you should be using your voice to do. And that was kind of where my awakening happened. And then I didn't really know where to go after that. I knew that I didn't want to stay in that business. And so I actually spent a couple of years. I did some art. I did a lot of painting, you know, as people do as they awaken in, they do creative endeavors. I did several, art, gallery shows of photography. One was, The Silver Linings of Clouds, which I ended up making a book of, that was all about searching for God, and how God appears to us, in various forms and shapes. It was actually with the premise that, because I actually took a photo one day of the sky, and I took many photos of the sky because my subject was the silver linings on clouds. But one day, without even knowing it, I was pointing my camera up into the sky, and as I was closing the shutter closed, I didn't really realize what I was capturing. But that night in my dreams, I was in the same place I was the day before, and I was taking pictures. And as I closed the shutter closed in my dreams, all of a sudden the world erupted in this volcano, and I immediately woke up in the middle of the night. And so I said, oh my goodness, what was that? I have to go back on the reel of film and see what. So the next day I put in my card and I'm looking, clicking through, and all of a sudden I'm looking and there's an eyeball in the sky looking back at me. And that became the premise for this whole idea for this book, which was, what would you do if you were looking into the sky and you saw a face looking back at you? Would you change? What would you do? You know, people have these ways of talking about God as if, you know, God were this third person that was somewhere else that wasn't privy to the conversation you and I are having right now. That, you know, that somehow is like not in my head reading all of my thoughts, you know, not, you know, I mean, woo, we have these really, very foolish imaginations of how the divine interacts with us. And, right. And so the whole premise of the idea was, well, would you behave differently if you knew that God was in all aspects of your life and with God was witnessing everything you said and everything you thought? Would you treat people differently? Would you love people in different ways? Would you judge people less? Would you give more of your excesses to other people who don't have those excesses? Would you? And that was the, you know, the leading principle behind this creativity. And so, you know, following that, I created this book and I thought to myself, well, surely I took a picture of an eyeball in the sky and surely people will read this and they'll get it. And, you know, and somehow I envisioned that there would be something else that would pop up after this, right? That people would say, oh my God, let's all grow into consciousness.
Yeah.
and a lot of people liked the book, but it certainly didn't have, you know, that thing didn't happen. And so then one of the other conclusions of the book that I found is that all we know to do when in doubt is just simply plant, do what we would do in nature, right? The laws of nature are the laws, the highest laws that we know actually exist. And so that is to plant good seeds and root out the bad. And try to cultivate those good things in our life and in our world. And so that's what I ended up just doing with my life, is that I ended up saying, well, what's the worst thing? Okay, the earth is on fire. I've definitely got that message. I definitely got the message that, like, I'm supposed to do something about it. And clearly just calling attention to our consciousness and the way that we treat one another in front of the Holy Spirit isn't sufficient. So what's next? And what was next was, it was about the time Obama was running for office and, you know, hope and change. And I got swept up in it and worked on his campaign. And then afterwards, the whole idea of getting healthcare for everybody was super appealing to me. And, I thought it was, you know, I think the statistic at the time was something like, you know, 35,000 people die each year, or at that time. I think it's less now, but probably not that much less, but because they didn't have access to healthcare. And I thought, horrible, right? This is something we can do something about. We can help people not die. Boy, if I didn't have healthcare, and I had a pre-existing condition, or I had some other, you know, whatever it was, I would hope that somebody would fight for me to have some sort of coverage and to look out for me, right? This interdependent system of society that we are all in needs to show up and fulfill its responsibility, right? We're interdependent when it comes to supplying goods and food and all sorts of other different services. But why shouldn't we be looking out for one another's well-being as well? Isn't that a construct of this? You know, when you hear somebody say, I made, you know, $10 million last year. And it's like, well, yes. And you did it with the help of somebody taking out your trash and somebody bringing you your food and somebody. And so you did. But if we just left you on, let's say, the peninsula of San Francisco all by yourself, it would be very difficult for you to make that $10 million without those goods and services being provided.
Right, absolutely.
This being able to view economic scenarios with this divorced perspective of I earned this is, while there is definitely a portion of truth in that, it certainly isn't looking at the bigger picture of the interdependence that we're all involved in. And, And so I got engaged with that fight, and you know, we lost the public option, which is a really big deal, but we ended up getting some people who wouldn't have been covered because they had pre-existing conditions covered, and that wasn't good enough for us. That made a difference in a number of people's lives, and so we did that. And then we ended up through that process, I got quite a bit of training. I was working with MoveOn.org at the time, and got a ton of training on how to organize, and they asked me to step into leadership, and I said no, no way, forget it. You can get somebody else to do that, and then. I kept going to the meetings, though. I felt like I needed to be there. And what I would notice, though, is that in grassroots activism, that you have these great people that come in who've got all of these skills, whether it's PR or graphics or sensibilities or relationships. Anyway, they really resourced people. But the resourced people always tend to be the most complicated personalities, shall we say, right? They're strong personalities, right?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And so especially in grassroots activism, right? Because grassroots activists are compelled by something. They're not generally people that are necessarily like mainstream, you know, let's go watch Will and Grace kind of folks. You know, they're really like consumed with trying to make the world better. And so somehow they don't always fit into you know, mainstream culture, assimilation culture. And so they tend to be stronger, more nuanced, interesting personalities. And God bless them, you know, for showing up, for getting out there to try to make the world a better place, is difficult as it sometimes may seem. And so what I started noticing is these strong personalities would come into our meetings and they would fight. They would start going at it like cats and dogs. And then there would be a big explosion in the middle of the meeting. And then the next meeting, those two people that fought with one another, neither of them would show up. And so I got sick and tired of watching that happen.
Understandably.
You know, and so the next time they asked me to be in leadership, I said yes. Simply because somebody had to intercede. And so I stepped into it, and we did gangbusters. Like, all of a sudden, the group grew at leaps and bounds. And it's just simply, and I was simply just being like a cheerleader, you know, encouraging the best in people, trying to discourage, you know, unhealthy behaviors or bad interpersonal dynamics, you know, encouraging, respectful, treat each other, you know, golden rule stuff, and bring that culture, try to create a culture in this organization, people. And we did really well. And so once we passed the healthcare bill, it was kind of this collective what's next. And at the time, we had been hearing about this gas drilling technique that was coming to New York. And when I first heard about it, I think in 2006 or 2007, I thought, this sounds brilliant, right? Gas is better than coal for the climate. This is going to be great. Oh my goodness, they can drill this right here. I didn't realize that there was a difference between conventional extraction, which is basically finding a pocket of oil or gas in the ground, and unconventional extraction, aka fracking, which is they find very, very small pockets of oil or gas in the ground, and they have to use water, sand, and chemicals, and around 400,000 pounds of chemicals in each frack job, right? And of those chemicals, we knew, and we were finding this out. So in 2009, the city of New York did a study that found that 32% of the chemicals cause cancer. 43% of the chemicals are genetic disruptors, right? Nothing you want in water supplies. 58% of the chemicals were immune suppressants. These are things that we did not want getting into our water supply. And so the more that we started realizing what this process was of using these water, sand, and chemicals to bludgeon rock formations to release those teeny, eeny, eeny, bitsy pockets of oil and gas, we started realizing what a dangerous, invasive, hazardous practice this was. And of course, then we started finding out the level in which the well casings, which is the protective layer that protects our aquifers from these chemicals, they fail at a rate of 1 in 20 in the first year. Over the course of 30 years, 50% of those well casings are failing, which is just like a ticking time bomb there for our water supply. Then we started realizing that, oh my goodness, volatile organic compounds, chemicals are being released into the air. Studies like the Colorado School of Public Health study came out, which found that there were, they were finding toxic airborne contaminants that were five times above the allowable limit, half a mile away from an oil or gas well. So that means that people within a half mile of an oil and gas well, and we're seeing people get these health impacts, but they're breathing, you know, benzene and, you know, all sorts of chemical contaminants, carcinogens that they should not be being exposed to. And we saw these health impacts in other areas like Pennsylvania, Ohio showing up. And then we saw things happening like earthquakes because of fracking. Anyway, so there was definitely a collective focus that after we, you know, did what we did with the healthcare, that it was time to, you know, move on, I think, to that threat. And for me, it was a little bit
specifically fracking. That was what you moved towards?
Yeah, that's what I moved on to in New York. And it was, you know, I considered at the time, you know, I considered working on marriage equality. That was like a big thing in New York. And there was like, but my thought process was, well, you know, if gay people like myself don't get married, they don't die for the most part. It's not like we're in a, you know, in, you know, a country in Africa where they slaughter, you know, gay people, or they stone them in Iran, for instance.
Right.
That's not an outcome for us here. But clearly, like, fracking is very, very dangerous for people in the United States. These are toxins. These are chemicals. This is a very dangerous practice that should have never been made legal. It should have never been exempted. How they call it, the Halliburton loophole. It was exempted from the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Superfund bill, a whole host of other laws that was done under George Bush's administration. Dick Cheney really pushed that bill through. I think it was like 2005. It was the Energy Policy Act. Dick Cheney, of course, used to be the head of Halliburton. Halliburton is the company that invented fracking originally and helped perfect it with its chemical cocktail contaminants that are used. And anyway, so we fought, you know, for this. And it was during that time that we were also making prayers as well. So we would make prayers for the water. We would sit in sweat lodges. Mona Palaka, one of the, 13 grandmothers, came out to New York a number of times, and did sweats with us, and we did other, ceremonies for the water, and really tried to hold things in a sacred way, while we were also running the campaign, because, certainly doing activism can be a very draining experience, especially if you're coming from a place of anger or upset rather than like a place of love. So there was a lot of learning that happened along the way with all of that. And of course, we had people that would tell me, David, you know, and these would be environmentalists. I had environmentalists that would tell me, David, you're so naive to think that you can keep the fracking industry out of the state of New York. You know, you should just be fighting for strong regulations and the best protections imaginable, because they're one of the most powerful industries in the world, and they're coming in whether you like it or not, and there's nothing you can do to stop them. And as it turns out, a few years later, we ended up banning the practice in the state of New York. And it was a whole campaign that we ran on the governor, but it was really leveraging science and political muscle to protect our water. And it was a really urgent call, and it was very powerful in which the way the grassroots and the people of the state of New York came together to do this. I've never seen anything like it. And we ended up getting a health study written that did an analysis of the science. And at the end of that health study, the commissioner for the health department of the state of New York said, I wouldn't let my kid live next to a fracking well. And if I wouldn't let my kid live next to a fracking well, we shouldn't let anybody's kid live next to a fracking well. There are certain ways we should make money and certain ways we shouldn't. And there's no way, you know, to put a positive spin on fracking. And so as a result, Governor Andrew Cuomo banned fracking in the state of New York. And kudos to Governor Andrew Cuomo. You know, he said he would listen to the science. There were times when we definitely thought he might not. And that was very worrisome. But in the end, he did. And it is a permanent ban. And so we protected the state of New York and this water. I mean, some of the water, the New York is known for its world-class water. And we protected that in perpetuity. That is a fracking ban that can't be overturned.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was so much information that just to condense it back down, looking at it, that speaks of a pretty clear journey. It was, you know, you were in the modernism, helping run a business and working in an urban environment. You went from there to artistic expression and self-exploration into political, direct working on the Obama campaign into political activism, and then into something closer to your heart, sounded like, with the healthcare and actually stepping into health. And then now to a wider aspect of health where health meets politics, meets the environment, meets your awakening energy being put into action on planet Earth.
Right. And stopping the hemorrhaging, right? Trying to stop the pain that is being inflicted on the planet, right? Be an agent of our mother, be an agent of our mother nature, defending mother nature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. As an embodiment of a being in alignment with mother nature, one could say a direct extension, you know, we are on the planet. We are made up of all parts that come from this planet. We in essence are this planet incarnate. And yet we sit and turn around and it's almost as if we're suicidal as a species.
It's true. I mean, in people aren't, you know, you hear a lot of people that they're not spiritual until they spend a couple of weeks out in nature. And then they say, oh, wow, I had this experience. And that's the way it's supposed to be, right? That we're supposed to maintain some sort of connection to where we come from. But because of our modern society, because of our cars and cement and houses and, you know, lights to click on and heat that we can turn on and, you know, clothing that we can throw on and all of these things, we've lost our healthy fear and respect of Mother Nature. And I think it's absolutely critical that we try and get that back, you know, that respect.
It's just the basics of what's even going on here. As we get farther into this modern era and see the onslaught of technology and digital influence on people's decision making and people's understanding of what is real, it seems that there's a disconnection between even just a basic understanding of where food comes from. But what you're talking about now, a basic understanding of where fuel comes from, that's powering everything that's going around us, people aren't really connecting all the dots that what's happening in their backyard is also correlated to the modern habits of an average American consumer.
Right. Yeah. Well, if I may, so you hit a buzzword where our food comes from. There are practices happening. Let me take a step back. So as awakened beings, it's absolutely critical, I think, that when we become conscious that something isn't right, or we become conscious that perhaps people are economically benefiting from systems that are not sustainable and dangerous for the commons and for the, you know, public health or public well-being. And I'm sorry, I have a chihuahua that is wanting my attention here. So as we become conscious of this, I think it's when we say, oh, gosh, that practice is terrible, right? Like, they're fracking and it's poisoning our water supply. Well, then how is it that I can become realized to try to have my actions align with my convictions, right? So fracking's terrible. So what am I going to do about it? Well, I'm going to call the governor, or I'm going to do this, right? But just, it's so important that we, I think, realize our convictions, right? And realize it and evidence it in such a way that it becomes a physical manifestation of our thoughts and our convictions. And I think that's absolutely critical for us to, it's great that we've awakened, and it's great that we spend time filling and feeding our souls, right? Because it is a very sick world. And so we have to keep our minds healthy and our hearts open and our brains conscious and at peace. And it does us no good to be conscious on a dying planet. And so we must realize, right, while seeing, you know, acknowledging spirit is in all parts, in all places at one time, spirit is watching what we do with our awakening. And spirit needs us to stand up, needs us to be agents of change. We are spirit's children, creator's children. And in this time of awakening, we have a great responsibility to act on behalf of creator and to be agents of change. And the best way to do it, again, is to plant those good seeds. I don't like fracking, or I don't like whatever it is. And then what are you going to do about it? So I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And if that isn't successful, then try something else.
Right.
Get with like-minded people. Create your own local community organization. Whatever it is, bring those skills. Maybe you've got PR skills, marketing skills, relationships. Bring those to a group, to a whatever. But hear that call and manifest that. And be a part of this community, right? What bonds communities together? Well, true communities, I think, are bonded by shared values, shared convictions, right? And shared action, right? You don't, the amount of power that we felt when we beat the fracking industry, a whole state of just individual citizens that had banded together, spending their nights and their weekends climbing on buses, making phone calls, you know, sharing things on social media, doing everything they could to try and hold this beast that was going to frack its water from coming into the state, and winning. It's that David and Goliath moment where you're like, we can do this. And I think we all need to stay with that, that nothing is impossible. Nothing is inevitable. That we may feel sometimes that, and this is one of those, I've gotten in ceremony before and in meditations, I get this, there's a reoccurring message I get that says, you know, you may think that these industries are very, very powerful. But the power of the universe is a very big place.
Yeah.
And there is a current and a power that is far beyond our small understandings. You know, sometimes we think as humans that we're very, very smart and we're very wise and we're very scientific and we're mathematical and we can, well, I can figure out that problem. But the reality is that, you know, human beings trying to understand God is very much like a dog. Trying to understand what's on television. You know, a dog may be able to hear, you know, Fido, you know, and it may be able to hear another dog barking, or it might hear a word or two, sit, stay, you know, words it knows. But by nature that the dog's brain is just too small, it can't get the entire message. And so is true for us as human beings. Now, we can try and calm our minds, so that God can have a little bit more of an impression there, and God's voice can come in, right? That we still our brains so we can hear creator and spirit. But by nature that our brains are too small, we don't get the whole picture.
So you were starting to say that, talking about how in a meditation you had received inspiration that these industries aren't as powerful, that there's this spirit behind us as well.
Right. So that spirit, right, is so much bigger than anything on this planet. And so that message that I receive is that don't you worry about them. I'm so much bigger than them. I'm so much stronger than them. And you have me. I am a part of you. and don't you fret, and don't you worry, and don't you think that's impossible to beat them, because I am the life force that goes throughout the universe, and their foolish ways will come to an end. And this is something that you can push back on. This is something that you can win. So don't think that their control and their economic dominance and their dominance over policy and rules and laws and regulations will continue. Just do what you need to do. Follow that instinct. Follow that fight. Fight the good fight and you will win. And I get that consistently all the time. And so I think it's really important for people to remember that things are nothing is inevitable. And to fight the good fight, fight the fight that you think you should be fighting. Fight for what it is you believe in and what you want. And win, you know. And so I think that's something that if I can impart anything to folks, I think that's a really important one. You know, don't step away from a fight just because you think you can't win it or just because you think it's inevitable. It's already been proven. I mean, imagine if Gandhi or Martin Luther King or, you know, any of our other, I mean, Abraham Lincoln, you know, went headlong into a fight, a civil war.
Yeah.
And people, you know, the abolitionists pushed him into it. And I mean, we're trying to do that currently with Jerry Brown with climate change. You know, Jerry Brown, I mean, imagine if Abraham Lincoln had said, you know, let's not abolish slavery. Let's regulate it. Let's make it more humane. You know, we don't want to break up the slavery economy. We're getting cheap labor. It's really good for business. It's good for the economy. People are making a lot of money. If we take away all this free labor, it's going to crash the economy. It's going to be terrible. We can't do that. I mean, he could have just as well have said that. And would we have remembered Abraham Lincoln? No way. No way. We wouldn't know that guy's name. It wouldn't be a household name. He wouldn't be on a coin. But he did do that, right? And so now currently in the state of California, we have Jerry Brown saying, well, we're going to address climate change by putting electric cars on the road. But meanwhile, last year, the oil industry spent $36 million influencing, lobbying our elected officials in the state of California. And as a result, we have studies that have been done, paid for by taxpayers in the state of California, that say that things like fracking is more dangerous here than it is in other places. And unless the oil industry can prove that fracking is safe, permits should not be issued. That is a finding from California state scientists. That finding was made 3 years ago. But meanwhile, no scientific or no policy has been put in place because the oil industry is essentially buying off our politicians and the whole political process. Also, currently, they found when they did this study, they studied and looked at urban oil drilling. What they found is that they're using hundreds of thousands of pounds of toxic chemicals, not just in fracking, but in all oil operations. And in fact, we have a study that was done that was an analysis of South Coast Air Quality Management District that found that in the past 3 years in LA County, they used 20 million pounds of hydrochloric acid, an air toxin, right? So hydrochloric acid will go into the air, will be a poison for people in those communities. And they're using this in LA County, right? So right next to schools and homes, they don't have any setback limits. There are no protections. And so they used, in the past 3 years, 20 million pounds of hydrochloric acid, 10 million pounds of hydrofluoric acid, which is what they etch glass with, and something like 120,000 pounds of ethyl benzene. There is no safe allowable limit for exposure to benzene. The EPA tells us you don't want any benzene, which causes leukemia, any exposure to this stuff. So that was another one of the findings of the CCST report. California Council on Science and Technology found that we should have human health buffer zones around all oil operations, that it's not just fracking or acidizing that's the problem. It's the routine well maintenance. It's prepping a well. It's cleaning out a well. It's some of the other things that they do with all oil operations. And so here the scientist, again, 3 years ago, came out and made this recommendation. People are likely being exposed to toxins in urban areas. Because of that, we strongly recommend we mandate human health buffer zones. Here we are 3 years later after we found that we were likely poisoning people. We don't know to what extent, but found that we were likely poisoning people. No protections have been put in place. Why? Why are these scientific recommendations being ignored? Because the oil industry keeps spending. One final and critical thing that people should know about, and you mentioned food, right? We don't know where our food comes from. There are currently four water districts in the state of California that are utilizing oil wastewater from fields that utilize these toxic chemicals, and they're not filtering it, and they're using that water. They take that water, they dilute it with other fresh water, and then they use it to irrigate crops. Currently, Halo mandarins, Sutter Home wines, organic grapes, other different almonds are being grown with this wastewater, and they don't filter it. There's no reverse osmosis. There's no – they take this water and they run it through walnut husks because oil adheres to walnut husks. They'll heat it up so that the oil will rise to the top and they'll skim it off. But there's no filtration. There's no nothing. They just shoot it down the pipe to mix it with the rest of the water. And, you know, Mark Ruffalo's organization, Water Defense, and some other groups have done some testing of this water, and they found acetone and benzene in the water.
In the water that's directly watering our crops, one yes. step away from coming to our tables.
Yes, that's exactly. Insanity. And this practice was going on for 25 years until it was just discovered a few years ago. And currently, there's an expert board that has been commissioned by the Water Board that has representatives of Chevron on it deciding whether this is a safe practice or not. And now the Water District, which financially benefits from this arrangement, is doing testing and saying, oh, well, we don't need any independent verification of this. We've got this one covered. But meanwhile, the board of that particular water district, the Coahuila Water District, the board is made up of farmers who financially benefit from this practice. In fact, so just to give an example, if you pump water from the ground in California, it costs you around $175 an acre foot. But if you get this water from the water district, you pay about $25 an acre foot. So if I'm a farmer and my three big expenses are land, labor, and water, maybe fertilizers, but those are my big three expenses. And if I can cut one of those expenses down to 1/8 of what it would have been, that's a lot of money in my pocket.
Yeah, it is.
That I wouldn't have had, right? And probably a cheaper price for the consumer, right, as well. And, of course, we're living in this environment. Well, I mean, we're partially responsible for this, right? We never want to pay the true price for anything, right? We always want to get things cheap. We always want to – right? Well, there's a cost to that. There's a cost to, you know, Walmart. There's a cost to our produce being grown with wastewater. Do we exactly know what that is? I shudder to think. So that's one of the other things that this study came out, the CCST report, and said, well, you shouldn't be using water from fracking fields. Well, what we now know is that they're utilizing the same chemicals in fracking, and there's been studies along these lines that they're using similar chemicals in similar quantities as they are in fracking in conventional operations. And so if you look at just a regular old oil field, they're still utilizing a lot of those contaminants. And up until just a few months ago, I don't know where we are with the practice now. I need to tune in with one of the scientists that's been really tracking this closely. But up until a few months ago, they hadn't even been testing for the chemicals that we're utilizing. And in fact, we can't even find out all of the chemicals that they're using in those fields. So there is, and I think it's safe to say that if folks knew that this was going on, they would be very, very alarmed and want to do something about it. And so, you know, I really encourage all folks that might be listening to this within the sound of my voice to, if that offends you, find out more about it. You can go – one way to do that is to go to protectcafood.org or to go to – Rootskeeper, rootskeeper.org is our website. You can sign up for our email list there. We're going to be engaging, continuing to engage on the agriculture and the wastewater and food issue, but also continuing the fight to protect people and communities. You know, we are current, and so back to Jerry Brown with all of this, is that Jerry Brown knows the science, right? He pretty much commissioned the science. And up until when the science came out, he said, we're going to let this study decide it. You know, this study is going to be the end all be all. And then the study came out almost 3 years ago. And like, zip. He said, I think at one point he said, well, we're going to put these findings into a committee. And then they're going to, and here we are like 3 years later. And it's like, well, where's the committee? What's going on? Well, we have to decide what the setback limit is. Well, it mandated temporary protections for people living close to oil wells so they wouldn't be poisoned while you're deciding how far away you should have these setbacks from oil wells. But what it is that if you actually implemented the setbacks, say like a 2,500 foot setback, which is about a half a mile, which would be about right, which is what Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles is calling for, and lo and behold, it would shut down 80% of the drilling in Los Angeles, which may not be a bad thing since that's where people live and go to school and try to live a healthy life.
Strikes me about that? Sorry to jump in, but yeah, one thing that strikes me is that if the oil companies had to stop drilling before the setback decision was made, you know that it wouldn't have taken 3 years.
That's right. But we're not there yet, right? I mean, it's not.
We're seeing the opposite. You're saying the blatant negligence at this point.
Blatant negligence, but culpability on the part of the people that are supposed to be sworn to look out for us, right? Our governor should be looking out for our well-being, and instead, he's, you know, sadly. So early on in Jerry Brown's tenure this time around, right? Because Jerry Brown was like the, you know, essentially like the Bernie Sanders of the 90s, right? Like in 1992, he ran for president and he said he wasn't going to take any more than $100 from any one source. And he said, why? Because I don't want to be influenced, and money buys influence. And he called it for what it was. Well, this time around, sadly, Jerry Brown's a very different person. He's taken $9.8 million from energy companies, you know, oil industry, but other fossil fuel industry companies, in the past 7 years. $9.8 million. And in fact, one of the examples, and this has been reported widely in like the San Francisco Chronicle and some other papers, but there were Alana Miller and Derek Chernow were two state regulators that worked in to regulate the oil industry, worked for the Division of Oil and Gas and Geothermal Resources as regulating the oil industry. And there was a Chevron worker that fell into a pit of like steaming, smoldering hot oil, because they'll sometimes heat up oil to get it out of the ground. And there was a Chevron worker just fell into a pit and bubbled and died. And this was happened like 2011 or something like that, in 2012. And so after that happened, these two regulators said, That's it. We mean business. We are sworn to regulate, and that's what we're going to do. And so Gray Davis at the time was working for Occidental, which was the second largest oil producing company in the state of California. And Gray Davis was the chief legal counsel for Occidental, which has now changed their name to be California Resources, Inc. Pretty innocuous, right? California Resources, Inc. They sound like they're going to really help us find
must,
our
– must be helping us with that resource responsibility. You know?
Exactly. You know, if there's going to be a sunny day tomorrow, it's going to be because of South California Resources, Inc., right? But that's not the case. So Gray Davis calls over to Jerry Brown and says, I want these two regulators off the job. I want them to back off. I want them, whatever it is.
The people who spoke up.
The people who are doing their jobs, right? Regulators are supposed to protect workers and public health, both of which they started to do. So Jerry Brown had one of his operatives go to these regulators and he said, back off. And they were like, no way, man, we're going. 2 days later, they're fired by Jerry Brown, fired him. And then within a month, 1 month later, the Democratic Party for the state of California received a couple of donations, one for $250,000 and another one from $500,000 from Chevron and from Occidental Petroleum for, I think it was Prop 30. It was one of his initiatives. It was like a tax increase or something like that, something he wanted to do. And they supported that. So it was like a total quid pro quo, right? But with a cozy relationship with a really toxic industry. So like, so here Jerry Brown is saying, climate change is the most, you know, important thing facing us at this time. We have to leave the oil in the ground. But meanwhile, oil drilling has increased under him in the state of California. You know, he's calling out Donald Trump for saying, Donald Trump, there's no way you're going to drill offshore in the state of California. We're going to shut that down. But meanwhile, under Jerry Brown, in the past 7 years, 238 well permits have been approved in state waters. State waters are between 0 and 3 miles offshore in California state waters, and Jerry Brown has approved those permits. So here you have this guy who talks this amazing game, right? And this is what we talk about spiritually, right? That you want alignment. Right. Consciousness brings alignment in our actions. It's this process of awakening. And here we have this guy who was almost a Jesuit priest, right, who was one class away from being a Jesuit priest and then went into politics the first time around. And then I think it was after he lost a race against, I think it was either Dianne Feinstein or Barbara Boxer, he went and studied Buddhism in Japan, and his teachers said that he actually reached a certain level of enlightenment while he was doing it, right? So here's this guy who's obviously like definitely like a spiritual being and, you know, one of us in that regard, but it seems like his consciousness is, you know, in terms of matching who he is and what he believes with what he's doing, has gone further apart in recent years rather than come together and found better alignment. And yeah. So we're actually going to be running a campaign. You know, this year he's doing this Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco, which he, you know, is trying to get a lot of press on, and be, he's trying to do it as basically a counterpoint to Trump. And I appreciate that and I value that. And I think it's wonderful that he's making those efforts. One of the things he wants to do is put 5 million electric cars on the road as a solution to climate change here in the state of California. I appreciate and I value that as well. But he's not doing anything about oil and has taken a lot of money from the oil industry and is not implementing the studies that we know would dramatically improve the quality of life of people in compromised communities like in Kern County, like in Los Angeles. And these are all, of course, low income, people of color, marginalized communities that don't have a whole lot of political power, where the oil industry knows to go and, give Rudy Salas in, you know, Kern County, $100,000 over the past few years or whatever it is, that they're buying off these elected officials who are then turning their backs on their own communities who are being poisoned by this dangerous industry. So we need to really, really, really push Brown, who knows better, to do the right thing. So we have, fortunately, because he's holding this Global Climate Action Summit, we have some leverage over him because we know where he's going to be, we know when he's going to be there, and we also know that he's very afraid to be protested in any sort of way when he's on the global stage because all eyes are going to be on Jerry Brown. And we're really serious about taking the message to him about, hey, Jerry Brown, what if Abraham Lincoln had said, let's regulate it? Right. Yeah, which is essentially what you're saying with the oil industry, but you're not even regulating it. Right. You're not even doing that. Would he have been remembered? And I think it's really important that we give that impression to Jerry Brown that, like, you are not a climate leader until you actually are a climate leader. Just because you want to say you are one and you do a few half measures that don't really fix the problem doesn't actually mean that you are who you say you are. Right. That actions prove our true convictions and prove who we are. And so we're actually going to be holding these We Are Praying For You, Jerry Brown events. We're praying for you to have the courage. We're praying for you to have the strength to stand up to the oil industry. We're praying for you to be that person that you once were, who swore off dirty donations from dirty industries, who said, I will not be bought and sold, that I will lead with character and integrity in regard to science and intellectual understanding. And we're going to be holding these events and ramping them up from, you know, now throughout the summer to really try and nudge Jerry Brown, like, hey, we're your people, and hey, we'll have your back, and hey, will help you make history. I think it's really important for people to remember, and for me to remember, that Abraham Lincoln wasn't always down to abolish slavery, that it was the abolitionists that really pushed him to take that principled stance, and that we can have that same effect now. Just in the same way that we banned fracking in the state of California, we can have that same effect on Jerry Brown, that Jerry Brown can be that kind of leader. He's got it in him. He's done it once before. He's sworn off this money before. And here he is. He's really soul searching. What do I want to do with my life? Who do I want to be? What do I want to be remembered for? And we want him to be remembered and celebrated as well. So that's why we're running this campaign. And so, that's one way in which people can plug in, you know, and there's certainly, sadly, with the oil industry and with these issues in the state of California, I wish it were just fracking that we were fighting. I wish it were just oil drilling in urban areas that we were fighting. I wish it were just the food stuff, but it's also the refineries. It's also the pipelines. It's also the oil trains. It's, you know, we have to really, to address climate change, we have to really start to wind down oil and fossil fuels. It's not to say that we have to get rid of it entirely. We might still have good uses for oil, maybe creating vinyls and things like that. Those are really nice products. But clearly, you know, plastics are poisoning our oceans. Plastic comes from fossil fuels. Clearly the climate change in carbon is, a direct result of the burning of fossil fuels that's causing climate change, fueling this. We have to wind this down if we are going to survive on this planet. And at such a critical moment, Jerry Brown has the power to do it. And he's got, I think, the makings of a true environmental hero. But like Abraham Lincoln, he has to be pushed in order to do the right thing. And that's where, once you develop consciousness, and once you develop peace, right, and once you recognize that you have a role in the world to move it towards better ends, then I think it's incumbent upon all of us to participate in our community of shared values to try to manifest that future planet and keep in mind that message that nothing is inevitable.
Right.
This industry is not too powerful. You know, you can win this fight. You didn't get awoken so that you would lose. No. Spirit and Creator knew to awake you because you had a role to play in the future of this planet. And there are generations, right? We always talk about the seven generations. There are generations of people that are waiting to be born onto this planet that we have a responsibility to serve.
Yes.
Those are our people. Those are us, right? And that, If we were that seventh generation, oh God, we would want us. We would be like screaming through the ages, do something for the sake of life. Do something so that I may come. And we all have to really hear that urgent call of our, not only our ancestors, but our future selves.
Wow, David, you're tuning into some almost archetypal influences going on right now. What you were just speaking about with Jerry Brown and how he has within him that environmentalist, yet he's being swayed by modern candy coming in the form of lobbyists that are being trickled down to him. This idea is actually true within all of us, right? That we all have that environmentalist. We all have that one side that says, hey, I got to do what's right. I got to be integrity with my values, with my heart, with mother, my mother, with my friends, with my community, with all of this. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of it is like, crap, I got to survive. Like, I got to survive day to day. And this actually hits really home for me right now as I'm looking at paths forward and I'm, you know, a young man on the planet and I have awakened and I've had a luxury of having explored those topics for a long time. And yet in coming through this next hurdle of like, okay, now what? There it's really clear what there is to do. It's like, now what? Okay, well, let's go save the planet, you know, like, let's help people learn community, let's help understand sustainability, let's redesign our political system so that it's not bought out by corporations and it actually does reflect the interests of the people. Like, what do we want to do with all of these different subjects? My heart knows. It knows right away. And I actually have clarity on my path moving forward of what the most obvious thing to do would be, which would be to work in eco-villages and set up sustainable societies. And yet, this morning, I wrote down, like, the inner conflict that was going through me. I wrote down strategies for succeeding in the current paradigm versus strategies for creating a new paradigm. And I kept getting caught up in, like, okay, I want to go spend the next several decades of my life in creating a new paradigm and in setting up new infrastructure that's going to support the vision of humanity that we can so clearly see right now. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I have to figure out how to survive until then to do it. And there are real pressures.
And that's incredibly difficult. I mean, and everyone's faced with that. And I think that's a little bit by design, because sadly, we live in a society that bases the primary driver behind all of our decisions are economics. And that's why I'm, like, really waiting for the, like, the sacred feminine to, like, come to the fore and, like, for women to run the world, because we wouldn't be in this mess if it weren't for men. You know, and, like, women wouldn't be like, oh, should we choose clean water or, you know, get this dirty energy out of the ground? You know, oh, we'll go for the dirty energy that may make money. I mean, fracking wouldn't exist if women were running the world. Let's, like, face the facts. Like, we would not be utilizing wastewater from an oil field that uses hundreds of thousands of pounds of toxic chemicals if women were running the world, you know, if we, you know, and because we just wouldn't be making those trade-offs. They would be making really pragmatic decisions. They'd be like, well, we may not, you know, have an abundance of money, but we'll have enough to feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and house ourselves, and we'll be eating clean food and drinking fresh water and clean water and breathing clean air, right?
Yeah,
and
recognizing abundance comes in many other ways.
Right, exactly. And recognizing that our priority should not be money as much as it should be public health and, you know, the love in our hearts. And success is really about the way in which we treat each other and the quality of our relationships and our relationship with spirit and the world around us. And that's, like, success, right? That's what we, like, take to our graves,
yeah,
right?
True prosperity, yeah.
True prosperity, right? The material. And, it, you know, and so this, so balancing these things in a world that's driven solely by economics and that we're born into, right? That this whole thing that we assimilate into, which is incongruent with who we are in our souls and as individuals, is a very, that's, I mean, the oxycodone usage, right? How many people are on opioids right now? How many people are on antidepressants, right? But people, the antidepressant stuff, again, all these emotions I can't deal with. It's all too intense. Let me pull myself away from it. A sign of a sick planet, right? That's being run by an economic driver, right? All the opioids, right? I'm in pain. Get me out of this pain, right? It's too intense, right?
Yeah, it's just too intense to exist overall.
To exist. So I just to numb myself, right? The use of alcohol, everything else. And this, these are signs, right? These are symptoms of our illness, of our collective illness that we're suffering through because we're trying to make quarterly profits rather than healthy communities. And
it drives me nuts.
You know, it does. It drives me nuts. It's heartbreaking because you look at it and you say, this whole paradigm is what's causing the pain. This whole paradigm is what's killing the thing that gave us birth. This whole paradigm is against our own best interest, but we're all feeding it. We're all, you know, and we're trying to find our way through it. It's incredibly unfair, but it's like we're stuck in a game we didn't even want to play.
Right, right. I felt that so many times.
You know, and that's what Jerry Brown is stuck in. I mean, Jerry Brown saw Gray Davis basically bankrupt the state. And so I believe, and I don't know, but I know that I think probably Jerry Brown has some pretty good intentions and is trying to do things right. I think that he can't quite, you know, we all have blind spots, and I think he's probably in the middle of a few, and there's certainly things I can relate to. I mean, he who is out without sin, right? You know, I mean, I know that there's things going good in Jerry Brown's heart, and I think he's just having a tough time reconciling all of this. But I think that he cut deals with the oil industry because he had goals. He wanted to do an big high-speed rail system, you know, and it's a heck of a lot easier to do that when you're balancing a budget. And guess what? You can balance the budget a lot better when you're working closely with the oil industry and when you're not pissing them off and when you're not – because the oil industry has lots of power. They can do things, a lot of things to punish you. They can – you know, there's politics. There's – politics in the quid pro quo system is at an all-time high here in the state of California, and Jerry Brown's in the heart of the game. And there is a part of me that understands the practicality of those negotiations. Sadly, that pragmatism is killing us. It is killing us, and it's killing people in communities, and is tainting our food, and is leading us into the abyss that he claims to lead us, he wants to lead us away from. And, you know, hopefully saner ideas and saner minds will prevail, and hopefully we can make impressions on not only on Jerry Brown, but some of the other folks that have, you know, their hands on the levers of power and policy, you know, as we move forward. But I think activation is the first step. You know, mindfulness, yes. Leading from a place of love, yes. But once you get there, activate.
Yeah.
Activate in whatever, and it doesn't matter how. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, I mean, I think evaluate whether you're being strategic and having an effect, yes. But utilize whatever skills you have to find your place in the world. A friend of mine says, it is now time for us all to play in the Save the World Symphony. She says, I don't know what instrument you play, but you better find your place in the score and play that instrument with all your heart. Because if everybody doesn't get to hear that song, there won't be anybody to hear it. Again, the latest statistic that I just read the other day was by 2048, 30 years from now, the fish in our oceans will be dead. All of them. All of them. That is a report that just came out from numerous scientists and advocates. I mean, even if that timeline isn't quite right, like maybe they're off by 20 or 30 years. That's frightening.
The idea is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You're talking about the foundation of the planet's two-thirds in water losing its life.
Water, and half of our oxygen comes from the ocean. Oh, we can't kill the ocean. We kill us when we kill the ocean.
We're watching the same thing with the forest, too. Not to digress far from the ocean, but I was just reading about how a healthy ecosystem would have over 50% forest on the planet. And that is because that allows for us to have the other half of our lungs. As we breathe out CO2, it breathes it in. That's like basics, right? Basics, humans. Come on. I understand that you can make an iPhone, and that's really fascinating to do that over the airwaves, but let's get back to the very basic fact, like you just said, that an enormous amount of life, whole populations, whole arenas that support life currently within the next 30 years, we're looking at having them disappear entirely.
Entirely. Like, that's just like, that's, if there was ever a call to action, it's that. It's that if you like this life, if you think this is a beautiful planet, if you have ever enjoyed laughing or smiling or hugging someone or holding someone's hand, now's the time to do everything you can so that we keep that going. There is this big party called Planet Earth that we have an opportunity to improve on and save for future generations. And God help us, but God helps those that helps them, that help themselves, you know. And and as a friend of mine says, a friend of mine, the woman named Lupe Anguiano, she was a former nun that went into working with people in housing. She left because she wanted to work in advocacy because she felt closer to God doing what she thought was God's work. And she's worked with Cesar Chavez and the No Uvas campaign, and then worked with the Equal Rights Amendment with Coretta Scott King, and then she founded this thing called Stewards of the Earth, and we've done prayer ceremonies, blessings of the ocean, and things like that. And she says, you know, David, we're co-creators with God. You know, we have to. God, yes, is there and guiding us. But we have to trust that once we kind of clean out a lot of our bad stuff and we, you know, try to improve of ourselves, that we have to believe and trust that our instincts, that the good things in us will actually lead us, and that we are working with God to try to implement a more beautiful vision on this planet. And I think that's as close to the truth as we might get, that we have an opportunity to co-create a beautiful planet based on higher principles and higher values, with the basis of like planting good seeds and rooting out the bad, with the basis of treating each other as we wish to be treated, no double standards, no disconnected ideas, trying to hold one another to account in gentle, loving ways, and learn from our mistakes in the spiritual sense that we learn because we fall down, it is that we learn, and allowing people to have the integrity to learn their lessons as they make mistakes, in the same way that we wish for people to do the same with us and be patient and understanding as we do, but certainly not shame or try to embarrass one another because of mistakes we might make or whatever it is. And that's what the opportunity we really have to before us to do this. And I truly believe that we will get there, though I truly believe that we didn't get woken up in this whole awakening with people that we see in their hearts and minds and souls around us, that it did not come in vain, that we are being awoken because we are going to rise to the task at hand, protect life on this planet, and that God will hopefully come and work with us so that we can get ourselves there. And we'll find that direction, and we will, it seems a very daunting task, but I think it's the same thing as, if I didn't have a roadmap, but I knew that I wanted to get to New York, I know that I would just have to start out east. I'll have to just take every mile as it comes and just keep heading in the right direction. And I think that that's the same thing for us now. We look at this task and we go, oh my God, how are we going to get off of fossil fuels and this economic, this world that makes all of its decisions based on economics? How do we get? And it's like, let's not have to think about all of this. Let's just say, what do we have for the next mile?
Right.
What do we
have
for the next 10 miles? You know, because that's all we're going to get to today.
What is the obvious next step?
Yeah. And to me, the obvious next step, and that's so we, and to tell this story, we ran this campaign called Oil Money Out. People can see a little bit of what it is by going to oilmoneyout.com. But we ran this campaign because we actually tried to get a bill introduced into the Senate that was stopping the use of wastewater on crops. And we shopped the bill around to numerous senators, and none of them would take it. And they wouldn't take it because they basically said, you want me to take on big ag and big oil? Are you kidding me? And we were like, yeah, it's public health. Yeah, our food's getting tainted. Yes, absolutely. We want you to – that's your job. You're an elected official.
This is obvious. I shouldn't have to explain it to you.
Right. But this at the same time, so, and then after that, when we couldn't get a sponsor, one of my advocate friends said, well, let's make an example of them. Let's go after them. Let's protest them. And I thought, well, we could do that, but then we might alienate one of our only few allies that we have who is even considering taking it on. What if we were doing a culture shift within politics and start to embarrass the people who were taking all of this dirty oil money that's standing in the way of us enacting science as our policy? What if we were to do that? And so we started this campaign called Oil Money Out, and we did it a year ago, and we've gotten a lot of our elected officials to swear to not take oil money, and we now have people talking about in Sacramento health impacts and what these things are doing, and we're making headway. So I think it's really important from that lesson. It's just to be creative, right? That the solutions will come to us, that we just have to listen, still our minds, you know, recognize that we have to, you know, keep our hearts pure, you know, make our prayers. I change the water on my altar every day. I light my candles. I try to sit and have some moments of peace and breathe every day, you know, and then look for those creative solutions, right? You know, I'm a big follower of the I Ching, and the I Ching is always talking about the creative will come to you if you create the circumstances for it, which allows it to come in, right? And that is stilling our egos, stilling our minds, letting go of desire, anger, jealousy, envy. Let those things, those ugly thoughts go, shed them, you know, take them out of your thought process and allow something better to become in. And then those things, I think, help us. Those things help us to guide us to make decisions and tacks. And I think if we allow those things to guide us, that co-creation process, all of a sudden these things that seem daunting and impossible become real. And so, you know, I think it's just allowing that path to unfold before us and making a commitment in our own lives, whether it's 5 minutes a week or 3 hours a week, but just doing something that takes us closer to that vision and participating in that common shared value community, so that when we all come to that place where we've changed the world and we're no longer basing all of our decisions on economics, but of higher values, we can say, hey, we did this together in our community with shared values. And that's beautiful. You know, that's the realization of what we envisioned, what we wanted, and then brought it to fruition. And that's I think the highest level of being able to serve the divine in our own true realization and awakening.
Yes. To so much of that. As sometimes as you've been talking, David, I don't know whether to cry, to laugh, to reach through the computer and hug you just for being able to speak into this with such clarity at these times. The energy that you bring, the clarity of a path forward, of your path forward, and your ability to now reflect on to how that path has worked for you and the wisdom that it's showing you about what is possible here and now. I mean, the nuggets along the way, I feel so honored to get to be sitting here in this space with you and sharing this conversation at this very critical time.
Yeah, well, the feeling is mutual, Matt, so thank you very much.
My pleasure. Here. Yeah, this is, you know, this is where we are as humans, and yep, you are hitting on the head of some of the biggest topics that we are all collectively staring in the face, and we have to do it together. There is no option otherwise. We can't continue on in some sort of pseudo-modernist ideal like you were speaking about earlier that, oh, you know, Steve Jobs is this mega entrepreneur and he did it himself. It's like bullshit. And he did not do it himself. He did it with a collective, and all of us were involved. And in the same way, we're all involved with the destruction of the planet. And I see that in my everyday life, and it pains me in the little ways that I have yet to adapt for how I want to shift my own practices and just, you know, from the little to the big across the board. And I am a co-creator in that. And I also am a co-creator in the solution. And the more energy and attention and focus we give towards those solutions, like you just said, simple as 5 minutes a week, but could be as much as dedicating your entire life to it now, as we are seeing with your example. That is where the work is. What are we continuing to perpetuate? The ideas of economics, the political system, the pharmaceuticals, none of that will exist tomorrow if we collectively as humans say, all right, no more. Like, we're done.
Right.
But what's required is for us to both internally make that decision and then now collectively reflect that back onto each other enough, with enough clarity of what is true and what the way forward is, that we collectively can take that step and make real, to realize ourselves as now a collective of whatever we want to say, awakened beings, of beings of higher consciousness, of people brought back to truth, of harmony and alignment with that which already is.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of people don't always see this, but I think it's important to remember that there's a lot of fun in that too. There's a lot of fun in that creative process of working with other people and sharing that experience and developing those relationships and learning about yourself through that process. That it's not, I mean, yes, it's a daunting task, but there's a lot of fun and creativity that lives there. And I think that we, you know, should embrace the task ahead of us with that consciousness of that it'll grow the depths of our being, but that it's something that I think, you know, not only will good things come out of it for the planet, but I think a lot of just enjoyment and love and abundance, will come out in our own personal relationships and in our lives.
Yes, yes to that. The more joy that we can bring into our daily lives, I think the easier it is to remember that that's not only an option, but that in the face of that natural joy and just being with each other, just how disconnected and untruthful some of these other energies that are pervasive here, how strange they seem when seeing right. The simple light of the heart and of love and being with each other.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right on, David. Well, before we leave, I feel we're coming to a completion here. Before we go, I would love to just recap how people can find you and support you, as well as the event in San Francisco coming up.
Sure. Yeah. So let's see. So I have numerous projects and websites that I work on. It all comes from the organization that I run, which is called Roots Keeper. You can find us at rootskeeper.org. If you'd like to find out more that's ROOTSKEEPER, Keeper of the Roots, rootskeeper.org. And then the other projects, oilmoneyout.com, oilmoneyout, all one word, .com. I just found out that our Faith Against Fracking website is down, so I have to go investigate why that happened. But faithagainstfracking.org when we get it back up. And then Protect CA Food, protectcafood.org. If you want to reach me, you want to reach out to me personally, send me an email at info@rootskeeper.org. There are two of us that read those emails. Occasionally one might slip through. We get a lot, but one might slip through that we don't see. So if you don't hear back from us, send us another, or just bump it back up in our inboxes so we see it. But we know, and I'm increasingly aware, that relationships and people who feel called to this work are the ones that are going to bring the change. So if you are feeling called and you're feeling like you want to be involved, please reach out. And get connected, and we can, help you find a way to be involved and, perhaps have conversations with your legislators or, create actions, make prayers, whatever it is, to try to shift consciousness, open awareness, and participate and grow our community of shared values. So, yeah.
Right on.
One, come all.
It's awesome to have this as a, what I want to say, I want to use the word role model. It's really nice for me, just as an individual, to come across you, David. I'll just speak from the heart here that, I spend a lot of time speaking about subjects like this and looking into them. And sometimes it's astounding to me how much I have to engage in the argument and point out what seems to be obvious. And then to fight beyond that, to make it real and to go against some of these other structures, even at some of the most Yeah, even environmental businesses and places that are, you know, with environmental products, and having to point out basic things like, hey, you guys, this isn't, you think this is environmentalism or capitalism as usual. But for me, what I was leading into, it's just, it's really a pleasure to get to hold this space. It's a pleasure to see you in action. And there's moments from this conversation I know I'm going to carry forward for a long time. This is a pivotal time when I'm open to a positive influence and looking for role models. And I think many others as well. We're awakening to the insanity and awakening to the discomfort that we all feel within our culture and within the world as is. And there are so many of us from such a deep place asking for help, for guidance, and for a way forward. You have very much helped and guided what my visions are for looking forward in this conversation with me, and I trust as well to many others who have listened. So from the depth of my heart that has been touched in this conversation, I want to say thank you.
Wow. Success. I mean, success, right? I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, is to encourage the best things in one another. I think that's the way we're meant to be, is to try to encourage us, you know, each one of ourselves to be the best and be the most effective we can be for our short time that we're here on this planet. And you know, let me just say, so that's success for me, like hooray, like oh boy, you know, I'll sleep well tonight. Because sometimes it's tough to, you know, see those measurables. But I'll tell you, one of the things I recognized early on, before we had the New York success and coming down this road, is that I realized, I think, how short this life on this planet is. And that eventually, at the end of this life, we go to that unknown place, right? And likely on the other side of that is creator or spiritual consciousness or whatever it is there, that thing that I keep interacting with that lets me know that it's there, that talks to me, that listens, right? That thing I'm going to go see in a very tangible, very clear way. And when I get there, I want that conversation to be very short. I don't want it to be, you could have done better. And you actually, you hear these stories from, like, there's, you know, a few, from people that have passed, that have died and then come back to life.
Yeah, near-death experience.
Near-death experience. They say that there's kind of a common thread that happens for many of them. And it's like they watched events in their life kind of flash before their eyes. And it wasn't like... you know, when they aced their college exam or whatever, but it was like definitive moments of their, that demonstrated their ethics, or moments where they were, that were pivotal in their lives, right? Both good and bad. And when I go there, I don't want to have a long conversation. I want it to be, you did your best. You know, come on in. You know, and I don't want it to be like, you could have done this better, you could have done this better, you could have done... Like, I don't want to have any of that. I would rather go for a more challenging experience that may not be easy street here, that causes me perhaps a little more discomfort and pain, and have salvation than the other way around. Enjoy easy street, rock it out, have a great time, whatever, you know, not pay attention to the things I believe in versus what I'm actually doing, and then have hell to pay, you know, at the end of it, of like, you know, you knew I was there, you knew I needed your help. You know, I want to be able to go there and say, if we don't win, it's nothing that I did. Right, that I did everything in my power to be successful. And so at the end of this life, I want to be able to say, we won, and it's, you know, and I was a part of it. Or if we don't win, to be able to be like, get to the end of this life and be like, well, we didn't win, but I gave it everything I could. And, you know, either way, that's our opportunity that we're given. And I am fully confident that we get to win. And I am fully confident that in the goodness of people and the goodness in all of our hearts that we can be won over, and that we will align ourselves and we will see a better tomorrow. It might be a few more tomorrows from now, but I believe in this. I believe in this dream, this planet Earth experiment, human experiment. And I believe that in the end, after we learn some lessons, that experiment planet Earth with the human experience is going to be successful.
Yeah, so. Me too. That's why I'm here. That's what I came for.
Well, cool, man.
On that note, David, thank you for coming to the planet, and thank you for all of the light that you share and this awesome place that you have come to be able to be living the life that you're living. And like I said, you inspired me. I'm sure you're going to inspire countless others through this podcast, as well as just through your waking daily life. So rootskeeper.org, definitely a one to check out. The Oil Money Out, we'll have this infographic on it that y'all should see. It definitely makes it simple to drop into the conversation. And if you're a visual person like myself, I actually picked that flyer up, one of the pieces of work that was just explaining the situation. I picked it up well before I ever knew that I was going to get to talk to David on this podcast. And it struck me. It tells the story in a beautiful way. So oilmoneyout.com is another one to check out. And then if you need to reach David directly, info@rootskeeper.org.
That's right.
Did I get all that right?
You got all of it right. Brilliant.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Bless you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for doing what you do. Together with all of our efforts, we win, you know? And so it's not just one of us. Nobody is going to bring the win alone. It's all of our contributions that make up this beautiful tapestry of love and light and beauty that will envelop the world. And so I'm just grateful for the work you're doing. And all of those folks that are listening, thanks for taking the time to listen. This is something we can do together, you guys, and I'm looking forward to it. You know, together we're going to do this.
Yeah, I feel the same. So thank you so much for listening. This has been another installment of the Sacred Economics Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Sacred Studies. I am your host, Matthew Isbell, here today with David Braun, and what a conversation that we shared. So thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Blessings.